Well, thank you all for coming. I'm very pleased to be here hosting this session. To put for a brief bit of historical context, this is the about the third year of the conference that there have been these evening panels featuring our guest writers and attending authors in an attempt to give them a chance to be involved in the conversation above and beyond the track of fiction readings and guest of honor presentations that are so much a part of the conference. And tonight, you've all got programs. You all know what all of these people have accomplished. So I'm just going to quickly note that we have on our panel this year's guest of honor, China Mayville, attending author James Morrow, attending author Susie McKee Charnas, attending author and past guest of honor Peter Straub, attending author Theodore Goss, and our other guest of honor this year, Kelly Link. And this is a chance for our writers to talk with us about the this year's conference theme on the monstrous. And now that I've done that official stuff, I'm going to sit down. And there is they've all got handouts up here, and I do not invite a lemming rush at this moment, but after the panel is over, there is a handout here. And I'm a little embarrassed because after China's this magisterial dismantling of the whole taxonomic enterprise and his talk today, the only handout I have is a sheet of paper with four categories on it, but it is something that is taken from a book that I also want you to be aware of, entitled Creatures, 30 Years of Monsters, that is a reprint anthology that features stories by China and Kelly and Dora Goss and three other writers who are here at the conference, Jeffrey Ford, Jeff Vandermeer, and this year's Crawford Award winner, Genevieve Valentine, and me. But since all those other people are in it, I flog it without guilt. And the piece of paper that we have up here is contains four categories that, in fairness to the editors of the book, John Lankin and Paul Tremblay, are not categories that are intended to be comprehensive, but they are rather just the way that the editors chose to divide the specific stories that are included in this book. And I'm just going to list these here, and then we can work them into the conversation as people desire or not. But the categories are It Came and We Knew It, referring to the familiar monster. It Came and We Could Not Stop It, referring to the relentless monster. It Came for Us, referring to the really relentless monster. And It Came from Us, of course, referring to the monster that emerges from ourselves. And one thing that's implicit in these designations, and that I've been struck by and some things I've been reading. Another thing you should be aware of is that one of the writers in this book, Jeff Vandermeer, and his wife Ann are in charge of a very excellent website called the Weird Fiction Review, and they've been doing 12 days of monsters of various posts of fiction and nonfiction and interviews that are directly in observance of this year's conference theme of the monstrous. And one of the things I found in the very interesting interview they posted with China and a very good survey article by Dora called A Brief History of Monsters is a lot, and that is in the editorial apparatus in this book as well, is quite a bit of pushback against the notion of the monster as other, the monster as a metaphor for evil within ourselves or things that we are repressed, and very much coming out in favor of the actuality, the literalness of the monster. And going along with that is the English teacher in me cannot help noting that the word monster is a noun. The word monstrous is an adjective. And I think it might be interesting to consider, you know, whether or not, you know, how do we differentiate between the two? Can we have the condition of monstrousness without a monster? Is it as monstrous if we don't have an actual monster to go with it? So just a couple of initial thoughts there, and I'll just start going down the line here. So, China, the monster versus the monstrous.
Well, I mean, I feel very simple about this because, I do think for me there is something very particular about the kind of the supernatural fantastic, the embodied supernatural fantastic. So, you know, I always chafe, for example, against definitions of monsters that involve that include things like serial killers and slashers and stuff. And I'm like, can they fly? Then they're not a monster. But yeah, I recognise this may be a kind of limiting definition. But to me, so I mean, the short answer is yes. Clearly, you know, monstrousness is all around us. For me, to retain some kind of useful specificity, the monster to me is that fantastic figure always.
Mm-hmm. Oh, who's next? Oh, John.
Well, Pache. Am I using that correctly? Pace, Pache, Pache, China. The first thing that came to mind when I was invited onto the panel and I learned of its title is we have a monster in the town where I live, State College, Pennsylvania. This is the monster Jerry Sandusky, who has been molesting children for well over 20 years. He's also, if you've seen the interview with him that's on the net, he personifies Hannah Arendt's marvelous phrase, the banality of evil. Just as she noticed that Eichmann was a person who evidently had never entertained an original thought in his life, had never had a notion that wasn't ready-made in some way. That seems to be the psychology of this man. But to pick up on Brett's distinction, we have our monster, Jerry Sandusky, and then we have the monstrous situation that nothing was done about this this horror, even though there was abundant evidence that we had a kind of Jack the Ripper in our community. There's something monstrous about that. I'm not sure how to parse it, and I would almost frame it in terms of one of my favorite literary works, Melville's Billy Budd, Four Top Men. You know, Claggart is the manifest satanic figure. That's the evil we can get at, the evil we can name, the evil that announces itself. But then there's the monstrous thing that happens to Billy Budd. Captain Veer, the agent of virtue, is responsible for this evil thing. And his is the evil we can't get at. Mm. It's irreducible. So maybe we can return to some of these thoughts later.
Susan?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm even more simple-minded than anybody else here. I generally think of these divisions in terms of the monster is a matter of appearance. It's something that is scary to look at or hear or feel. The monstrous is a mode of behavior into which anyone can fall. It doesn't. You don't have to be a monster to do monstrous things, which is kind of what you were saying too. And I think the fact that one is a noun and one is a what's the other one adjective makes it clear that there's a distinction between monstrous acts and things that look like monsters to us or are perceived as monsters by us. And personally, having written stories about monstrous beings from their point of view, I kind of tend toward the idea that a monster is my perception of something that I think of as a monster. From the monster's point of view, it's not a monster. Mm. It is a perceptual construct, and it can shift according to what the culture regards as frightening and scary and awful and horrible and unnatural and all those other things. It can shift according to the time that the discussion is being held in, what's considered monstrous and what isn't, or a monster or what isn't. And I think it's up here. And we'll find out for sure when we run into those beings from a more concentrated parts of the universe where the only way to survive as a being on a very heavily radiated planet is as a beetle. It's going to look monstrous to us, but it's not going to look monstrous to itself. And it may behave monstrously or not.
Peter?
That is, of course, is an excellent point. Adolf Eichmann did not appear monstrous to himself. Jerry Sandusky, according to Jerry Sandusky, I'm sure was completely justified in everything he did. And like all creeps of that kind, almost certainly would have called it love. One thing that's very suggestive, it would not have occurred to me to have brought up this particular instance, though it is it was in our faces for weeks, as it should have been, because it was such a blatant case of mismanagement and of institutional corruption. What always follows in the train of a monstrosity like that, and I'm very happy to use monster, the adjective monstrous as the direct product of the monster, because it allows us to widen our discourse considerably. One thing about the monstrosity of this particular kind is that it regenerates itself. It passes itself on. It's communicable. There's a great couplet by Philip Larkin. Man passes on misery to man. It deepens like a continental shelf. What I'm talking about here is the view from inside trauma, which is would be the viewpoint of Sandusky. We don't know what happened to Sandusky when he was a kid, but I think one might well make guesses, though that is not at all an excuse. But the view from within trauma is different in relationship to objects than the view of that hasn't been subjected to that particular torquing. I would say, and I think this is the part that interests me, that, well, there are many other things about this that interest me, but one thing related to what I just said is what was suggested by an object relations psychotherapist in the 50s, a man named Michael Balint, who described two different relationships to space and objects, and he had great terms for these relationships, and I cannot remember the phrases. The first, however, is that the spaces between objects are terrifying, are riddled with threat, and the objects themselves are comforting anchorages. If you attach yourself to an object, then you're safe from the real terror of being exposed to the space. The other is the reverse, of course, that it is the space itself which is liberating and the objects which are filled with menace. The point of view I just represented to you is that of a mind subjected to the monstrous and which has then partaken of it. I'll stop there.
And I changed my mind. I'm going to stand up because I can't see the other table otherwise.
But I don't have to stand up, right?
No.
Okay.
You can't.
That's quite all right. Yeah, I hope this makes sense. I just took a page of notes, so this is probably going to come out confusing. But coming at this as a scholar, I guess, I want to keep the term monster useful, and I think that if we broaden it too much, then it becomes less useful for us. So when we talk about someone who's a serial killer, for example, as a monster, we're using the text as a sort of metaphor. We're saying this is someone who is like a monster, who resembles our idea of a monster, but I don't think that's the core of the term. And for me, the core of the term goes back to the idea of the monster as something hybrid and liminal, but in a sense, we can go all the way back to the original idea of a monster as a portent, a warning. This is something that Brett wrote about in his introduction, I believe. So the monster serves as a warning or a portent, you know, like a ram being born with two heads. Right? All of a sudden people are looking at it and going, what in the world just happened here? Clearly this means that some nation is going to lose in a war or some leader is going to fall. This has to have some greater meaning. And the reason they're searching for that meaning is that it's a break in the natural order, right? It's something that has happened that is no longer natural. And so in a sense, when we're applying it to serial killers, we're saying we want to label this unnatural. We believe that this is monstrous, even though, unfortunately, I think you can make the case that being a serial killer is a perfectly natural human act because people have done it throughout history. But the idea of the monster then, I think, has a kind of core. And the core is something that is that breaks the natural order, but that breaks it in such a way that it still relates to the natural order and still it's sort of, and this is where I'm going to get confusing, it both is and isn't, right? It's different from ourselves, but it's also something we recognize about ourselves. So the core of the monster and what makes the monster so disturbing is that it's, maybe this relates to what Peter just said, it's outside and inside. It's self and other. It's not just the other. It's the other that's also the self. So, for example, Mr. Hyde is sort of an obvious example of the monster. He's everything different from Jekyll, right? He's everything we're not supposed to be, everything we don't want in society, and yet he's also inside, not just Jekyll, but he's inside all of us. So this idea of the monster as liminal, as boundary crossing, I think is, for me, is central to the idea of the monster. But I do want to say one thing in relation to what Susie said about monsters not recognizing themselves, because I think one thing you see in literature are these moments of recognition, actually, very interesting moments. And the paradigmatic one for me is Lovecraft's The Outsider, when he looks in the mirror, and it's almost like this mirror scene happens over and over again in text, and it's like Lovecraft has captured that particular moment and written a whole story about it. It's the moment where the monster looks at himself in the mirror and says, yes, I am a monster, and recognizes his own identity. So I think the recognition of the self as monstrous is part of the narrative and is, in fact, one of the things that makes the monster so scary.
Before I forget the point, I wanted to raise it to what you were saying right at the beginning. In keeping the term more specific, so you would say that, you know, Frankenstein's monster is a monster, Godzilla is a monster, but a serial killer is engaged in monstrous behavior, but you would not identify the individual human being doing those things. You wouldn't call him or her a monster.
I think that we say that is monstrous behavior because we want to identify it as something that is unnatural. It's almost as though we're using the term descriptively, saying this is what we label. We're using it as metaphor, I guess, is what I'm saying. We want it to be unnatural. We want to say this is unnatural and outside of the human, even though we kind of know that it's not.
Callum?
I would agree with that. I guess I would follow up by saying that I don't really like thinking of any kind of human actor as being a monster. That seems very uncomfortable territory to me. I think it is an effective metaphor, and I think that monsters make an effective metaphor for almost anything you want them to make. But to me, it diminishes the possibility of the monster. And I think what monster does is an object that monstrousness, in the way that we've been talking about, what monster does is it's there's a kind of a marvelousness or a possibility of enlargement about it, that the reaction of the person who sees the monster or who encounters the monster is there's a response which is an outsized response, and there may be identification, there may be a feeling of pity, there may be just a feeling of marvelousness that you have had an extraordinary encounter, and I value that. You know, even in writers like Lovecraft, where there's a lot of where he does a lot very effectively with language that sort of suggests disgust or discomfort, there's still that sense of wonder. I wanted to follow up a little bit on what Dora was saying about looking in the mirror, because I think you could probably go through almost all key monster texts or narratives and find that moment where they either look in the mirror and see themselves and recognize themselves or are unable to do so. And with the vampire, they cannot, in fact, see themselves. And I think it's interesting to sort of run through all those and think about them. The last thing I will say is the other thing that I think that the monster does that monstrousness doesn't achieve is the monster is a moment or an agent or an opportunity for carnival, for chaos, for disruption. And again, that goes along with that sense of the marvelous.
Well, what you're saying leads me back to the third category from the Creatures Anthology, It Came for Us. And I think that may even be the section that your story is in. I can't remember. But what the editors say there, which to me seems very similar to what Kelly was saying, is that monsters, I'm quoting from the text, monsters aren't always indiscriminate. For every juggernaut that tornadoes across the page, there is another creature that takes more care in choosing its victims. It's as if that secret narcissistic sense we have as children that the world revolves around us is being validated in the most horrible fashions. And the protagonists of such stories share a kind of election, however terrible it might be. They have been chosen, singled out for a glimpse of the world's hidden engines. And when you talk about the idea of marvelousness and the possibility of enlargement, you know, it makes me think of that the encounter is terrible, but it opens up some degree of possibility.
Isn't that the meaning of that French phrase, the monstre sacré? The sacred monster. Yeah, which is the thing which tells you that liminalism is real. Mm-hmm. There it is, and it came to you.
Right, that it is something that comes individually to you. And it also makes me think about one of several phrases I jotted down from China's lunchtime talk, which is, ecstasy is only a short hop to terror. And which in turn leads us to a word that I've encountered a lot in glancing about various things about monstrosities, which is the idea of the sublime. The idea that the sublime connected to the uncanny, and the idea of the monster is the incarnation of all of these things. So coming back to China, who I see has been jotting things down, how do you see that working in terms of this idea? Well, of the monster is discovery. It's discovery of something. It may be something awful, but it's something different.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, to me, this underlines. I think what Dora and Kelly have said in particular, I agree with the notion of, and that's why that's why I think they've said in a much more kind of rigorous way. What I'm groping at about the importance for me of that fantastic element of the impossibility that's embodied. I think there are. I am also very uncomfortable with the designation of anyone, including Eichmann, as a monster. I think that's an exoneration of the viewer that is very troubling and that absolves us of the need for kind of social analysis, which is why I think, you know, what the job that the metaphor does of talking about individual purveyors of appalling acts as monsters, to the extent that it's an effective metaphor, it's a very dangerous one. It's a very dangerous one, and one I think that we use at our peril, as opposed to monstrous, which is a very useful phrase. I was reminded of Iris Murdoch, The Sea, the Sea, where there's a character who glimpses a sea serpent. It occurs, it's like four lines on one page. And the entirety of her life is shaped by this glimpse of this thing that she knows can't possibly exist. And to a certain extent, that's a there's something kind of overdeterminedly paradigmatic about the fact that this none more literary novelist has this kind of, you know, grumpy four-line eruption of the impossible that becomes this kind of absolutely perfect ne plus ultra depiction of the monster as epiphany, as portal into something else. And I think that notion of monster as revelation of into precisely what you're talking about, the ecstatic, the numinous, the godhead. The question of whether the pleroma is a positive or a negative experience is moot, but the monster is opening that up, I think, is nicely exemplified in that. And you see that in loads and loads and loads of monstrous texts. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it.
I can't resist saying that my own story in this book is a story about a woman having a luminous encounter with a sea serpent. So if any future scholar asks me if I was influenced by Iris Murdoch, I'm now prepared to say absolutely. Never. And of course what you're talking about there raises another issue, which is the idea of we have the sort of Freudian reading of the monster as repression, but there's also the instance of the idea of the monster in a broader social context and the social consequences of monstrosity. I was interested in what you noted in your interview, that what you take away from Frankenstein is not, there are not things that man are not, is not meant to know, but that this is someone who is not taking responsibility for his actions and is not taking responsibility for the results of his actions. And I think, Dora, you mentioned somewhere along the way of the Cyclops, right, from Greek mythology. And whenever I teach the Odyssey, I'm always struck by the fact that the monstrousness of Polyphemus is not so much that he's a giant with one eye, it's that he has no manners. You know, that he is just outside the Greek code of civility, and that he's sort of an outlier along there. So I was wondering if anybody had any thoughts about the idea of the monster, the monstrousness in this broader social context, or even just if you do see any a dichotomy or a conflict between the Freudian notion of the repressed and you know, more so a social text reading of it.
Well, we seem to have a dialectic going here about applying the word monster to humans. I think of Frankenstein, which has the overt monster, the creature that is manifestly not of the natural order. What a Necker cube of a word that is, monster. You know, what a reversible cube this whole concept is, because the affection we have for these creatures. You know, I don't want to take the tentacles away from you. You know, I write about Godzilla. But I think if we don't like the word monster as it might be applied to Victor Frankenstein, we have to end up, I think, damning him, not the creature, and not even Victor Frankenstein's act of hubris, but, as we've been saying, his desertion of the monster, the fact that he's such a bad parent, such a bad teacher, and does not live up to his obligations.
But that's not monstrous behavior. That is normal human behavior. All of us know people who behave this way and think it's okay or it's good for the child to neglect them and make them tough. I mean, it doesn't strike me as monstrous. In the framework of the story, it comes off as monstrous because it's balanced against the visual monstrosity of Frankenstein's monster. But I think it's a mistake, really, to think of that as monstrous behavior. It's bad behavior.
Ironic, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, okay. But it's bad behavior. You know, we don't like it. It makes us uncomfortable, but I don't think it's monstrous behavior.
Yeah. Well, it's the thought I have every time I see a news report about somebody who's done something terrible, some parent who's killed his or her children, and everybody, oh my word, how could anybody do that? Well, obviously they can't.
But if we're talking about the Cyclops, I mean, what you said, Brett, about the Cyclops was interesting. You said he has bad manners, right? So do the gods.
Right? Oh, yeah.
I mean, the thing about the Cyclops is that he behaves in a way that has nothing to do with the sorts of codes of hospitality that are there for the Greeks. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have to because, I don't remember his parentage exactly, but he's the son of Poseidon, right? He's beyond those sorts of codes, just as the gods are. And one of the things that we're doing, if we're using the word monster to apply to human beings, is we are losing that sense of the numinous. I mean, Victor Frankenstein, talking about his actions as monstrous, is something very different from looking at the monster and realizing that there's a reason that Victor meets him in the Alps, right? I mean, the reason he meets him in the Alps is that the Alps are the place of the sublime. Mm. And then they go up to the North Pole. You know, how much more sublime do you get than that? This place where horror and the divine meet, that's the monster, maybe. But that's very different from being in the Black Wolf Herent.
Quite right. I don't think anybody could disagree with that. I've always thought that the movement toward the Arctic is one of the most beautiful elements in Frankenstein. It certainly has to do with the sublime, with the terror before, you know, a vision of beauty of some kind, and it's foreignness and it's estrangement from us. I'm not happy, however, with a refusal to disallow human monsters from the appellation of monster, and I don't think it is a way to separate ourselves from the acts committed by these people. Sexual predators are one thing, but persons like Jeffrey Dahmer are rather another. And I'm pretty sure that at some point Jeffrey Dahmer looked at himself in a mirror. The only reason I'm pretty sure is I read it somewhere, and admired and his own monstrosity and was appalled by it and saw in it the same sense of sublimity and terror that we would see elsewhere in the world. And I think this is not an uncommon delusion. I think we do ourselves a disservice, and a disservice I don't understand, really, if we wish to separate that sort of grandeur from our own psychology. I think it is I think it's profoundly embedded in us. I think it's one of our capacities. And it's something that we can handle or not, that we must learn to deal with, and to, I don't know. It seems to me not to to make things easier on people if we call very aberrant people monsters. As long as we understand that kind of monstrosity is human. Monstrosity that isn't human is another matter altogether, and it seems to me to be rather less interesting. It may be sublime if you in Frankenstein, but, and it's in the movie Troll Hunter. It's kind of sublime there.
You saw that too?
These huge things. I think when human beings are in contemplation of a real or imagined being of that sort, they too... two irreconcilable kind of conceptions come to the human. One is, by God, that critter's big, and I'm very small. But also within oneself, one says to oneself, I too can be very big. I have this within me. I don't want to disavow the analytic reading, because I think we lose something profound and beautiful if we do that. And really, one of the points I wanted to wind my way toward here has to do with a sense of estrangement, a sense of disenfranchisement that monstrosity often arouses. I've been working with stuff like this for a long time now, and I've evolved a point of view which I sometimes hesitate to express, but I feel nonetheless that it is a truthful, basic, foundational matter about human life, that the more dissociated and disenfranchised you are, the more you actually understand the way things are. The comfortable viewpoint, which would in fact say, "Oh, that's a monster. He certainly doesn't have anything to do with us." You know, that viewpoint is of course naive and self-protective. But a profound perception of things that do throw us out of our frame, I think are necessary and good. That's about all I have to say.
We also can I.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah, please.
Just that I think that there is a... I don't know if it's a special category. I'll begin by thinking of it as a special category for by in which the, you know, a human becomes... enters into the category of the monster, becomes a monster, and that is by an act or by a thought which is a taboo, which is not... transgressive in a minor way, but in actual fact is taboo, and right. Taboo in the sense that you are doing something which belongs to the gods. You're actually going against what it means to be human.
And you would know that if you did. You would know it and accept it.
Yeah. Yes, and it is in fact an enlarging act.
Mm-hmm.
But that I think is there. That to me feels like a special category of human monster, and that it is, in fiction at least, very hard to pull off.
Yeah.
Because monster also works on a different kind of level as a metaphor for all kinds of human behavior. In a way that doesn't actually feel true.
That's right. I didn't really intend what I just said to be applied only to a situation like that. And what I have had at the back of my mind was the experience of walking through recent sculpture by Richard Serra, which I had no sympathy with or affection for this work until I saw it and began to move through it. I don't like Richard Serra personally, and to me his work always looked really ugly, except for when seen from above, when it looks like weird, beautiful tracery. However, when moving through one of those more recent pieces, you don't know where you are. You don't know which direction you're moving. You don't know if you're ever going to get out. The geography on the ground where you are walking changes and narrows, but the geography above alters in a different way. And you are profoundly put out of your comfort zone, to speak in hideous cliches, but you are also in some almost transformational way, disenfranchised. You are made to experience a kind of duality and uncertainty, which strikes me as being profound and valuable, and a condition which really should be sought and valued, not rejected. So that's where I am.
You were going to make a point a minute or two ago.
Flew away.
I wanted to say something about this, the return to this question of the human as a monster, and starting from Dora's point, which I think is key, which is the necessity of using this as a useful category, and therefore, you know, of course we can use it in any way we want, but the question is, you know, at what point does it stop being useful? And it seems to me there's an interesting conundrum about the use of the term monster, which is that it's an absolute commonplace in literature, in movies, and so on, that we have sympathy for the monster. This is almost a given, and this is one of, you know, the great, you know, we shed a tear when King Kong dies. Even Grendel, who in some ways I think is kind of the archetypal monster qua outsider, you know, Grendel alone in his, you know, under the water. There's a pathos to it. That sympathy is designed to be dissipated by the deployment of monster against humans. When we turn around and say Eichmann is a monster, the point of that designation is to eradicate all sympathy, eradicate it completely. And that trace, which we find in the literary and aesthetic monster, is designed to be gone. So something weird is happening to the category of monster along that line. And this is why I do want to defend the idea of it as connected to the sublime. Because it seems to me that part of... if you think of the sublime, you know, this notion of it being related to the ecstatic tradition. The ecstatic tradition religiously is all about an unmediated relationship with Godhead without the intervention of a priestly caste. This is why it is a radical movement in its early stages. And this is part of the reason something like Grendel becomes a radical figure, is because you have a creeping sympathy for someone who is notionally there to be, you know, the bogeyman against the social order, because on some level you know that the social order is not all it's cracked up to be. And that's why I think the aesthetic monsters work that way. When the monster is deployed politically, it is the social order itself telling you these things are monsters, we cast them out, and thereby bleeding out that trace of sympathy, bleeding out that trace of the sublime. And I want to conclude this by suggesting that this has been taught to us by, in the most elegant way possible, by Neil Gaiman. In Sandman, there is a brilliant section in Sandman comic where the Corinthian, who is a monster, goes to a serial killer's convention and stands up at the end of the convention and says, "You think you are monsters. You are banal. You are nothing." And that, to me, is, if you like, the answer to this question. How dare you degut the ecstatic and the monstrous by mere humanity?
To follow on from that a little bit, I think part of what you're talking about is the fact that we really are desperately sick of ourselves and each other, and we really want something else to be there that is not really us, does not reflect us, does not contain us, does not connect with us, but is still there and important and underlying and all-pervasive.
It's hard to know, I think, where to make the cut. I mean, we seem to have agreed earlier that Mr. Hyde was a monster. One of my favorite moments of recognition in drama, and that's Dora and Kelly were speaking to this, in Doug Wright's play Quills, about the Marquis de Sade. At one point, the Marquis, locked up in Charenton Asylum, in conversation with a curé, spits on the curé's Bible and says, "This monstrous god of yours, he strung up his own son like a side of veal. I shudder to imagine what he would do to me." Now, the Marquis de Sade, whether we want to categorize him as a monster or not, is such a transgressive figure in a way that's repulsive and attractive all at the same time. And I think while he's not sublime, I think he's a real achievement in that play.
I love Angela Carter, and I'm disagreeing with her here, but there's very little more banal to me than the Marquis de Sade. But the point I want to make
but
is
but
that
he does recognize, how deformed he is, in a sense. Okay.
But is that interesting?
It's self-awareness.
Is self-awareness enough? But what I wanted to introduce is the idea, since we're talking so much about the human monster, that we have had human monsters, and nowadays we don't call them monsters. They used to be called monsters. Nowadays we call them freaks. And there's been quite a lot of scholarship done on, for example, 19th century freak shows. And I had a lot of fun reading up on this stuff over the past summer. And that, it seems to me, is a much more precise and much more interesting use of the term monster, because the 19th century freak show performers, the bearded ladies, the hairy men and women, they really did transgress in interesting ways, not necessarily by what they did, but by what they were. And they called into question the boundaries of the human by not just being wolfmen, but by being presented in a particular way in their performances, by being advertised as missing links, or somehow breaking the boundary. This was a big thing at the time. I mean, there were the handbills, if you look at them, talk about a particular performer, for example, as the original missing link, proving Darwinian theory that the human really is connected to a primate ancestry, right? And there is something about that that is both frightening for that particular society and sublime, because it does stretch the category of the human. This reminded me of something I saw recently, and I showed it to my students, and they're sort of attracted and horrified by it. And some of you may have seen it. It was on YouTube, and it was sort of billed as the man turning into a tree, Does anyone remember that from several years ago? It was a man, I think maybe in Indonesia, who had a problem with growths on his fingers and his feet, and he really looked as though he was growing branches. And that on the one hand, it's a very sad and troubling for him medical condition that reduced him to poverty. On the other hand, it's the human version of what I think is the genuine monster, which is something that does break these categories and that's both repulsive and attractive, that invites our sympathy at the same time as it makes us shudder.
But it's also...
It seems to me that what you were saying means that sympathy is not permitted, that they're seen as real outsiders who exhibit a quality that closely aligns the monstrous to the grotesque.
The one qualification I would make is that even in the 19th century freak show performers, we don't necessarily think of them this way, but there was quite a lot that did invite your sympathy. There was a woman, the one who was billed as the original missing link. Her name was Crow. She was from what was then known as Indochina, and you had these pictures of her that showed her as kind of savage and hairy, and then you also had newspaper articles about her that showed her as a proper English girl. And this was someone that you were invited both to look at as a spectacle and as something strange and other, but invited to sympathize with as a little girl who was potentially transformable into a good subject of Queen Victoria.
So that's, now you're talking.
That's your monster of appearance again. It's not a monster of action. It's
correct.
The appearance of a monster. And that invites reinterpretation as an extension of human capacity in a physical sense. But these people were not considered monsters in the sense of doing monstrous things just by the nature of what they were, but looking monstrous to us.
It's
and I think that's what you meant by grotesque.
The grotesque also incorporates a quantity of the noble. I'm thinking of what John Ruskin wrote about the grotesque, which he found in Venice in architecture and statues. John Ruskin, one wouldn't expect to respond this way, being puritanical, easily shocked, moralizing. When Ruskin was 4 years old, he stood up before his parents and their friends and delivered his first sermon that began,
"Oh my God,
people be good." Now that this is where Ruskin got was to see the grotesque at its highest in Dante, and to assert that only societies developed as far and as beautifully as human society gets. Could express the nobility in the grotesque, that there were degraded, forms of the grotesque that were expressed satirically, which didn't interest them at all. But the thing presented with a kind of godlike nobility in it, I think God is calling me right in front of me.
God blows a horn? Wow.
My name is Susan.
This is the horned God.
Oh,
hey?
That's a hard cut. I'm still. Did you like that?
Love to do it again, man.
I missed four texts. Well,
one thing about what Dora was saying, and she's right. I mean, the whole 19th century freak show, and even going into our own day. I mean, Jim Rose Circus. I don't even know if that's still around. But, you know, that appeal is still there. But the idea. If you're looking at someone in a freak show, then yes, you have sympathy for them, and it's a sympathy of, well, you know, that's not me. But I think unlike a constructed monster like Frankenstein or the supernatural monster, there's always the possibility that could be me.
Exactly.
You know, there is, I will refrain from going off on an autobiographical digression about some long buried history of some monstrous birth in my own family about
then do refrain
years ago. caused my grandfather to be terribly concerned when I didn't, when I was slow learning how to talk. The idea, there's that it could happen to you.
Yeah.
You know, you're not that, it's just throwing the dice.
But you're still in there. It's still you.
That is precisely the bipolar, bifocal point of view that I was trying to advocate.
I think especially of perhaps the most famous case, the elephant man, John Merrick, who was, by all accounts, a noble person on the inside.
I want to make sure, and of course there's no way that we can even be, we're just starting to scratch the surface here, but I do want to make sure that there's at least a little bit of time for questions from anybody who might have anything specific to ask or...
I was hoping you might be able to speak to the relationship between language and monsters. Of course, we have some monsters who exist within the sort of mirrored circle of language trapped within us, in which we can sort of communicate experience, etc. And those monsters that exist sort of outside of that barrier of language. And I was wondering if you might be able to speak to how that might position in this argument regarding whether or not we should use the moniker monstrous to describe something human or something other.
For the purposes of the recording, the question was about the relationship between language and the monstrous. So, anyone?
I guess I would tackle part of that, which would be that there are sort of three possibilities in terms of language communication for the monster. One is that the monster does not, cannot communicate. The other is that the monster has something to impart or to tell you. The other is that the monster is telling a lie, that it is a lie that will destroy you. Those are sort of the three interesting categories for me.
What if it's a lie that will transform you?
Maybe not monsters in the same way. Then.
What sort of lie do you think? I'm very interested in this. What sort of lie do you think monsters tell? What sorts of lies?
I think the baseline example would be the idea of Satan. The angel that lies.
The father of lies.
The thing that's not quite a god or a human, but which is trying to deceive you.
Other questions? Yes?
So far everybody's only spoken about monsters in terms of beings that have some kind of agency and sentience. And I'm just wondering if people have an opinion on possible non-sentient monsters during
the text of the year. The question is sentient versus non-sentient monsters.
You mean the blob?
I don't have a particular example of the blob.
A lot of what has been said up here has been about the importance of the monster incarnate, which implies some degree of agency. And so the question is, does a monster or the monstrous work if there isn't that kind of sentience or agency accompanying it? And that is just a force as opposed to something we can look at and feel either sympathy for or terror.
Well, isn't that sort of the dialectic that's going on between Starbuck and Ahab throughout Moby Dick? Is this, a creature of just blind force that does not have anything against you, Captain Ahab, versus it's, some kind of personified deity?
Yeah. One of my favorite monster movies of recent years is the Korean movie The Host, and that's a very... almost abstracted force there. I mean, it's an incarnate creature, but it's not Godzilla. I don't recall much sympathy for that particular monster, at least when I was watching it. Well, other questions?
I think there you're talking about the horror story, where something happens. It's not necessarily a monster, but we perceive it as monstrous because it happens out of nowhere. We don't understand it, and we don't see it. We just see its results.
Or some part of the landscape begins to devour people. I mean, that's the only non-sentient monster I can imagine. And that's so banal,
There's a question over here. Yes, you. Yes.
What about the monsters that people choose for themselves. I'm thinking about the Caribbean, Latin American, and African identification themselves with Caliban over Ariel. Where does Caliban fall in relation to Grendel?
The
question regarding people choosing their own monsters and you know, certain groups identifying more with Caliban than Ariel, for example.
Identifying or being identified with?
I think that people, the groups of that groups who might identify more with the monster than with the presumptive hero of the day. Is that a fair statement of what you're saying? Identifying more with the monster than with the presumptive hero? Calling and claiming the monster for themselves.
God bless them.
I can't address this in terms of sort of post-colonial stuff because that's not quite my research area. I realize I'm sounding very like scholarly, like here's my area here, but I've been talking about this in terms of gender recently, which is that if you look at representations of women at particular time periods, what you find are these very interesting representations of women as monsters. So when we're talking about artistic movements at the end of the 19th and at the beginning of the early 20th centuries, you find in Art Nouveau, in symbolism, etc., you find leopard women. You find vampires.
Vampires, yeah. I know the book you're talking about. It's
which,
a good book.
Dickstra's Fantasies of Feminine
Evil. A wonderful book.
Which is a really fun book. But you know, the thing that the thesis of this book, for the most part, is that these are misogynistic representations. But there's this one moment when the author, Bram Dickstra, who's an art scholar, says, you know, if you are forced into this kind of bipolar, bifocal, by something identity, which is you're either going to be an angel or the monster, you might want to identify with the monster because the monster is more powerful and the monster is more interesting. And if someone is telling you that you're a monster, you might want to turn that representation around and say, I'm the monster.
The monster has more, the monster has more choices than the angel. The angel is good by definition.
I'm trying to think about the history of this, and it seems to me, in the case of Caliban, it clearly is that sort of almost trans-historic issue of the kind of the disavowed knowledge that all is not right with the body politic that is casting out the monsters. When that reaches the colonial context, that's why Caliban is such an incredibly poignant figure. And to a certain extent, I think it's not a surprise that's a figure that's been reclaimed. And we can argue about or debate the political efficacy of actually using that. The political efficacy of reclamation, I think, is troubled and moot, but it's a very understandable strategy. And there's an anecdote from the Zimbabwean liberation struggle, the Chimurenga, when this is back when Mugabe was a goodie, and the government put out a leaflet comparing him to a variety of different animals in the you know, like he's a baboon, he's a dog, he's a this, and the and ZANU put out a kind of counter leaflet. Entirely self-consciously and playfully saying, yes, you know, the commander can take many forms. The commander is, you know, has the power of the beasts, you know, this sort of thing. But the interesting thing, like, originally I was going to say that the people who choose to that act of reclamation are those who are at the sharp end of the disingenuous body politic, those people who are being ground down by social order, you know, colonial subjects or women, people of colour and so on. But there's an exception. There's actually a really interesting exception, which is the shock troops of reaction. also self-identify as monstrosity. And the body politic, which will disavow monsters, will say, you know, when times get really tough, you crack out the monster. What was the ultimate rearguard shock troop of the Nazis? Operation Werewolf. You know, you look at the hard right, look at the death squads in Latin America, and they will self-identify as monsters. And frankly, the beginnings of this you see in the kind of death's heads insignia worn by plenty of regular troops in the colonial metropolis.
We had one question back there. Yes.
I had a question. I noticed particularly with myself that, like, the first and deepest monsters that I personally identify with are things like, you know, the shark tooth from Land Before Time and the big crusher from the Brave Little Toaster movie and other things from my childhood. And what I realized this kind of has sort of says about me and then my experience later of literature, monsters in literature, monsters in film, later on in my life, is that I compare them to that sort of early internalized element that I picked up early on and my understanding of monsters as a child. And what I want to hear from you as sort of both creators and understanders of monsters is how you come at the problem when you're creating and understanding monsters of both, you know, your early internalized conceptualization of monsters and other people's early internalized conceptualization of monsters. When you're creating another one, how do you create a monster from nothing or from something that you know to be in people that is going to compare to something that you have to, if you're assuming that monsters exist in general, which sort of is the purpose of this, you know, whole thing. If you're assuming that monsters exist and that people understand that monsters exist, how do you compare, how do you create something which compares to people's internalized understanding of the existence of monsters as happens early on when they are, you know, small?
So how do you live up to the expectations in childhood?
Do your best.
I think what you are attempting to do when you're either working with a particular example of a monster or trying to come up with something new, you're attempting to draw upon your own, the things that attach you to that representation, but you're also hoping to engage the reader in your it is a call and response. You are trying to do enough groundwork in describing a monster that the reader will supply their own monster, more or less, in response to the bits and the pieces that you're laying out. So I think that new monster, if it is an effective, one, in part because it is a collaborative effort, and it will change from reader to reader. Everyone is going to have a slightly different monster.
And I've been given word that we are, unsurprisingly, a little over time here. So we'll have to conclude with that. I want to, there, if anybody
have to stay.
Is interested,
we'll get more.
Here. And I want to thank our distinguished panel of professors.